Nowhere in our travels chatting with clinical investigators will you find a more committed and passionate medical oncologist on the topic of translational research than Dr. Heinz Joseph Lentz, who met with me to talk about how his vision can potentially play out in clinical practice. And to make the point, he presented one of his patients.
I saw a 36-year-old patient with newly diagnosed metastatic colon cancer, and she had diffuse liver metastases. She saw her oncologist in the HMO insurance plan, who told her she has maybe 6 to 9 months to live. So she was not very happy with the approach and not giving her any more hope with new treatments. So we saw her in our consultation, and it became clear she had really extensive liver metastases. And she wanted to know about clinical trials and treatment options.
Where was the primary, and what was it that was making people or you decide that hepatic resection was not going to be on the table?
Okay, so the tumor was on the right side, and the involvement of the liver was in both lobes. Based on number and size, it was not resectable.
Could you talk a little bit more before you start talking about where things went with her, this terrible situation, what her life situation was and her state of mind when you saw her?
She was devastated by the first consultation, but her friends and family said, I think you need to get a second opinion and explore all the options available. And they're very interested in order to seek potential clinical trials which may increase the benefit of chemotherapy.
Did she have a spouse, children? What kind of work did she do?
She is actually in the entertainment industry. She is single but has a boyfriend who was very supportive. The whole family and the friends were actually looking on the internet for the best treatment options and the centers with expertise.
What actually caused her to seek medical care?
She had abdominal discomfort and blood per rectum.
So this is just catastrophic, acute situation to this woman, 36 years old, who sort of instantly finds out that she has an extremely serious problem. What were you thinking about?
She walked in, she looked healthy, and she was willing to try everything. She came in and said, listen, I know I have a very difficult disease to treat, and I know I can die with this, but I want to give my best shot, possibly, and trying to get all potential treatment options evaluated. I understand there is no guarantee, but I don't want to give up without a fight. So my first impression was, wow, this is a woman who is willing to go all the way to really explore options which would be not necessarily considered standard.
And now you're talking about options in the first line setting?
Yes. So one of the biggest controversies or options we have in first line is, of course, the choice of chemotherapy between FOLFIRI and FOLFOX. And I think in the general community and even in countries, these are replaceable in form of efficacy and the extent of toxicity. The most thoughts are put in that maybe oxaliplatin has more neurotoxicity and should be considered or kind of balanced based on potentially physical or occupational history of the patient and comorbidities, but not necessary for efficacy. So our approach from that was, you know, there are significant differences. Patients, some of them will respond very well to FOLFIRI and others very well to FOLFOX. And we have established over the last couple of years a molecular signature. We know with certain genes, FOLFOX will not work and FOLFIRI has a higher chance. So we explain that to the patient and saying, this is not an accepted standard, but from our experience, we think we have a higher probability to assign you to a treatment which is more likely to be beneficial. So we did actually the testing for two genes which predict sensitivity to 5-FU and oxaliplatin. And one of these genes is actually tested prospectively and validated in patients with non-small cell lung cancer, and this gene is called ESCC1, a DNA repair gene.
They talk a lot about that in the adjuvant setting. That's where I've seen that in non-small cell.
Right. And this is coming more and more. I think one of the major issues in developing this marker is, of course, the technology, how this marker is being developed, by what method is it PCR? Is it immunohistochemistry? Is it with laser microdissection and so on? So it takes usually years to really validate and establish a biomarker. But we know if the level is high, platinum-based chemotherapy will be unlikely to be of any benefit. And actually, data show these patients may benefit more from irinotecan. So we tested her, and her genes were actually off the hook. The TS and ESCC1 were so high that I knew that oxaliplatin would be very unlikely to be of any benefit for this patient. Now, in most circumstances in the United States, most oncologists would have given FOLFOX Avastin, as it has been the most used combination regimen in the United States. That's not necessarily true in many European countries. So we choose FOLFIRI because she had high levels of TS and ESCC1. Now, we enrolled her in a clinical trial, 8045, where the choice of chemotherapy was up to us. And we choose FOLFIRI, and we let the assignment go to either cetuximab, bethesuzumab, or both. We actually also tested KRAS, which was wild type.
And I guess at this point, that trial that Alan Vanook is the principal investigator on is now at only really 4 wild type patients?
That's correct, yeah. And actually, I'm running the molecular correlate section of this clinical trial, and we are now in the process of analyzing retrospective all patients involved to really validate the KRAS data, not only for the cetuximab containing arm, but also potentially for the bethesuzumab containing arm, if there are differences.
That's interesting. Do you see that there could be a relationship between effect of bevacizumab and KRAS?
Yes, there could be.
I don't know if I've heard that.
No, I think we are one of the few groups who looked into that. There are actually very interesting data linking the KRAS mutational status to DNA repair and therefore the efficacy of oxaliplatin treatment. And there is a significant correlation between mutant KRAS and the expression level and regulation of VEGF. And when you think for a moment, for all clinical trials done with FOLFOX, with anti-VEGF treatments, either bethesuzumab, PTK, ACD-2171, all these trials were disappointing or negative. The reason is, based on the data we have by now, is that mutant KRAS increases ESCC1, makes oxaliplatin potentially more resistant, increases VEGF, which makes it maybe more sensitive to anti-VEGF treatment.
So wait a second, you're saying KRAS mutant would be more sensitive to bevacizumab?
Could be. Yes.
Has it been looked at clinically at all?
Not yet. So there are data. We actually went back and did 200 samples of the CONFIRM-1 and CONFIRM-2 trial. And we found very interesting relationship that patients with high ESCC1, the ones who do not benefit from oxaliplatin, had the most benefit of PTK. It seems oxaliplatin sensitivity and anti-VEGF sensitivity goes the opposite direction.
Oh, let's not go too fast here. Can you just back up a little bit? What was the design of the CONFIRM study?
Okay, so CONFIRM was the first and second line chemotherapy for patients with metastatic colon cancer who received FOLFOX plus minus PTK, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor of the VEGF receptor 1, 2, and 3.
So that was the CONFIRM that didn't CONFIRM.
That's correct.
Because it was a negative study.
Yeah, but when you look at the response rate, the progression-free survival, and overall survival in CONFIRM-1, which was in first line, the data are extremely close and similar to the 966 study, you know, the CELOX-FOLFOX plus minus bethesuzumab trial.
You're not saying that irinotecan period is a better drug than oxaliplatin.
No, I do not.
It's a subset of patients.
Yes.
Which exact ones?
What I'm saying is that it seems like patients who benefit most from bethesuzumab may be also benefiting most from irinotecan and not from oxaliplatin.
Hmm. What do you think about the VEGF TKIs that are out there? What's the difference? Again, what is 2171? How is that different from PTK and the other one that you were talking about?
Right. There is a whole array of family of tyrosine kinase inhibitors to the VEGF receptor families. Almost every company has one. The big difference is actually the binding sensitivity to the receptor or the tyrosine kinase binding domain. Now, some of them have also additional targets, such as c-KIT, which is the reason that sutitinib or sorafenib are also used for GIST tumors. So they have a whole array of other targets. Some of these TKIs also target FGF receptors or PDGF receptors. Now, why would that be important? Because FGF receptors and PDGF receptors may be mechanisms of resistance to anti-VEGF therapies. So they may be more powerful to inhibit angiogenesis by inhibiting the pathways tumors can overcome inhibition of VEGF pathways alone.
So what happened to this woman?
So we treated her with FOLFIRI. She was randomized to bethesuzumab and cetuximab. She had no major toxicity except grade 3 skin actor-like rash, and she continued to show response on CT scan. Because her disease was so extensive, we did not think she would become easily resectable. So we did CT scan every 6 weeks. Her tumors continued to shrink, and after 8 months, in combination with PET scan, we identified that there may be a way to resect her tumors, which are still active or visible on CT or PET.
What was going on with her primary?
The primary was resected before we started her on chemotherapy. So she underwent, actually left hemocolectomy prior to the start of chemotherapy.
Now she got FOLFIRI, Bev?
And cetuximab in 8045.
Right, okay. You stated that she had a grade 3 rash. Well, how did it manifest itself? How did it affect her?
Right. So she was heavily counseled that this rash can happen, and she was aware the more skin toxicity she would develop, the more likely she would benefit from cetuximab treatment. Her rash was particular in the face, in the upper chest and upper back, the typical areas where you see the acne during puberty. Since she's a young woman and actually continued to work, she was a little bit embarrassed that people would look and stare at her since she had significant facial involvement. After we started her on doxycycline on a systemic protection, that actually corrected her skin rash very well and quickly, and the visible side effects were actually almost not any more detectable for patients or people who didn't know her.
So you considered hepatic resection?
Yes.
What happened? What'd you do?
So she was seen by our hepatobiliary surgeons. For patients with liver-limited disease, even not resectable, we actually include our hepatobiliary surgical team from the beginning. They deemed her unresectable, as mentioned before. We followed it up, and every 6 weeks with a new CT scan, they saw her in consultation. After 8 months, they decided that this actually would be a potential resectable situation. They did a trisegmentectomy and 2 veg resection and 1 high-frequency ablation. So really extended disease, and I think we are very fortunate to have a hepatobiliary surgical team which also does liver transplant. So they know the liver extremely well and were very aggressive.
I'm going to just divert out because this case reminds me of the fact that we're working on a project right now to put a fourth button on the Adjuvant Online website. Right now it's breast, lung, and colon.
Yes.
Hopefully by sometime in 2009, there's going to be a fourth one called Met Resect.
Perfect.
And it's going to be an attempt to provide education information for patients in this kind of a situation. You know, we spent like about 6 or 8 months working with all these people and, you know, lots of people you're familiar with and trying to read the literature. And finally, after about 8 months, I turn around and say, well, in terms of determining whether somebody's resectable or not, can we just simplify it down to 2 issues? A, Is there a tumor that's abutting on a critical surface so that you can't get a margin? B, if you take all the tumor out, are you going to have not enough liver left, which would be 20% in a completely normal person, 30% diabetic, etc.? And is that sort of like it? So I ask you, because that's kind of the conclusion I came to. Do you agree? Or
yeah, to be honest, I think for patients with liver-limited disease, we have a responsibility to make sure that these patients are treated the most effective way and are evaluated by really specialized surgeons. Because I think if you really are able to shrink it, you make a difference between cure and palliative care.
But in terms of trying to figure out if somebody's resectable, do you think those are the two main sort of issues, or is there anything else?
I think the liver-limited disease, absolutely. But I would include patients who have limited lung lesions.
Yeah, oh no, that's a whole other thing. We're going to talk about that. Lung lesions, portohepatous nodes is a big issue.
Yes.
Simultaneous primary, as in this woman, is a big issue. But I'm just talking about the liver right now. So
absolutely.
I'm guessing what happened to this woman was when they first looked at her, they figured if they take everything out, there's not going to be enough normal liver left.
Oh, they couldn't. Yeah, it was all over.
And then she had enough of a response that sort of from a volumetric, and I don't know, did she have volumetric studies of her liver to see, you know, what would happen?
Yes. So she had about 40% liver left, but this 40% included areas where disease was seen before. So we knew it would be a high-risk resection and a really high-risk tumor recurrence in areas where tumors were seen on CT PET but not visible anymore.
Right. And I guess the other thing I've seen is that people believe that even if you see a clinical CR, if you go in there, they're going to see tumor cells.
That's correct. I mean, the studies clearly show with negative PET, negative CT, negative CEA, 40% still have microscopic disease.
And I guess, you know, when you talk about a high recurrence rate, I mean, it really is kind of problematic to think about a person going through this type of surgery and then ending up with progressive disease, all the suffering they go through. What happened to her?
So we actually resected her, which I think is very critical, and this is not often done. We looked really carefully at the pathology because the pathology showed 99% tumor necrosis. So the disease we took out was highly sensitive to chemo. And I think it makes a big difference when you take a tumor out which is necrotic or a tumor which has no necrosis, particularly for the decision for further adjuvant chemotherapy. So we analyzed the tumor again. We had a hard time to get actually viable DNA out of this necrotic tumor. But we continued with the same treatment for an additional 3 months of chemotherapy and followed her up. After 1 year, she developed a recurrence of 2-centimeter lesion in the area of the former spot of one of these diseases. So
was that one of the ones that was surgically resected, the one that was RFA'd?
That was actually in the area of an RFA.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
So, and we know that is a higher risk for tumor recurrence in this area because it's just protected by blood flow with the heat. So we did actually CT scan every 3 months, and we caught this with a CT scan, and it grew 2 centimeters in 3 months. So we actually started treatment again with FOLFIRI, bethesuzumab, and cetuximab.
Can I just ask you before you go too far, how was it for her to go through the hepatic resection? Was it difficult? Did she have problems?
She actually was doing quite well. The major complaint, she was really fatigued and tired. She was kind of had no energy left. It took her about 6-8 weeks to recover from the surgery. Not any particular GI bleed or liver dysfunction or nausea or pain or anything like that. More kind of it was taking the wind out of her sail feeling.
And just also to just go back to some clinical points, what did you do about treatment as date of surgery approach? I know you stopped the bevacizumab. When did you stop it? When did you resume it? And what about the other drugs that she was getting?
Right. So usually I stop Avastin for major liver surgery 8 weeks before, just to make sure there is no active anti-VHF antibody in the body. But we continued with FOLFIRI alone until 4 weeks prior to. Even she had 8 months of chemo, she had really normal liver function. So she did not have any increased transaminases or alkalic phosphatase indicating a potential hepatosteatitis or hepatodilatation in the biliary tree.
What about post-op? When did you start her back?
So since actually she was not feeling strong enough. So I waited actually 8 weeks. Usually I try to do it earlier, depending how patients feel. So it would have been no problem to start 4 to 6. But in her case, we started 8 weeks.
And same for everything?
Yes. So we did the same treatment for an additional 3 months.
Right. And okay, so one other thing before we get back to the second part of what you're talking about, just to sort of track into that initial management. Another thing that you made a decision, or somebody made a decision to do, was to resect the primary. Now, was she having symptoms from the primary?
Not really, but you know, she had some blood in her rectum, so she was bleeding a little bit. And the tumor was near obstructing, so I did not want to take a chance for aggressive chemotherapy. So we decided to do and take out the primary tumor prior to start of chemotherapy.
And again, just to pick your brain about how you approach this, then if the patient isn't bleeding and isn't obstructing and there isn't any critical issues, do you still generally take it out, or
No. If the primary tumor is in place with no major threatening issues with obstruction, bleeding, pain, I actually leave the primary tumor in place.
And of course, a more complicated issue is the issue of somebody with a primary tumor and hepatic-only metastases.
Yes.
What are, again, you know, some of the strategies that you and your team there use? Do you have patients where you take them both out at once? Do you start systemic therapy usually? How do you think that thing through?
So it comes actually to a lot of clinical information. So we usually do not try to combine a primary tumor removal for tumors which are in the transversus colon on the right side along with liver resection. Because, you know, a colon surgery is not sterile, it's dirty. The liver is clean. So you have significant more infectious complication depending on the site of primary tumors. This is much easier on the left side. It depends on the extent of the liver involvement. If you have more than 50%, we would not take out the primary tumor because the mortality and morbidity goes significantly up. So usually we try to take out with any clinical threatening features the primary tumor and then continue with systemic chemotherapy. If the primary tumor is in place because there was either increased risk for surgery of the primary tumor or the liver lesions, we start with chemotherapy, monitoring very carefully, and then do either a surgery combining both, or we actually plan a two-stage surgery depending on the location and the extent of the primary versus the liver.
I got a feeling we're going to be talking about this case for the entire discussion, but let's keep going. One other sort of side point I want to pick your brain about. You were one of the investigators on the BOND 2 study.
Yes.
And this lady got combined therapy with cetuximab and bevacizumab. Where are we with that whole thing? To me, it seems like it's been kind of disappointing the way it's played out. And looking at her right now, do you have any feel for whether or not giving these two drugs in her situation has been helpful?
Certainly, my experience with the BOND 2.
Could you go through what you guys looked at?
Sure. So in the BOND 2 clinical trial, patients with refractory cancer were randomized to a combination of irinotecan, cetuximab, bevacizumab versus cetuximab and bevacizumab alone. There was significant efficacy in refractory patients to the both monoclonal antibodies, which was further enhanced by the addition of irinotecan. Now, this clinical trial did not only strike because of significant efficacy in highly refractory patients, but also because of low toxicity. There were no overlapping toxicities and certainly no additional toxicities unexpected.
Kind of like what happened to this woman.
She had no major toxicities. So I was really surprised when the first data came out from the first-line chemotherapy regimens combining EGF receptor monoclonal antibodies in combination with bevacizumab.
Now you're talking about PACE and CAIRO 2?
That's correct.
Can you go through what those two looked at and what they reported?
Okay. So PACE was a clinical trial where actually you had also a choice between FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, and patients were randomized to bevacizumab versus bevacizumab and panitumumab. And CAIRO was FOLFOX versus bevacizumab and randomized to bevacizumab and cetuximab. So both arms showed either bevacizumab alone or combination of panitumumab or cetuximab in combination with Bev. Now, these clinical trials both showed similar patterns with increased toxicities in the arm where both monoclonal antibodies were used, and the efficacy were decreased, measured by response rate, progression-free survival, which raised a lot of concern about overlapping additional toxicities, not only with the toxicity profile, but also compromising efficacy of chemo.
But didn't they basically, in spite of the problems with toxicity, receive a high fraction of the planned drug?
They did. But the problem is that overall, particular in the early toxicity and early death rate in the PACE trial increased significantly. And some of the explanation is that you can have GI toxicity with the EGF receptor inhibitors, particularly with chemotherapy. When you get more neutropenic, you may increase neutropenic septic complications. And that may be part of it. But there was significant increased toxicity in the combination arms with chemotherapy. What was the surprise that the efficacy went down despite all the data and safety from patients from the BOND-2 clinical trial? And I think we still not understand today what really happened in this clinical trial. Now, one of the reasons I think what happened is certainly that KRAS sorts out patients who benefits from cetuximab or panitumumab. And just what we discussed in the beginning, that the partnership of chemotherapy may play a significant role.
But am I correct in saying they looked at the KRAS wild and they still didn't see that much?
They didn't. That's correct. So it's more than the KRAS alone. I think the KRAS will not explain the differences in the toxicities and efficacy. I think what happened is, like we have seen in the other clinical trials, particularly the oxaliplatin-based combination with bevacizumab, that maybe some of these patients, when you add cetuximab to it, may not only not benefit, but may be harmed by increasing mechanism in the pathways, increasing resistance to certain chemotherapies. In other words, some, when you add in certain condition in subset of patients, both antibodies, you may increase resistance to chemo.
So I just had like a little bit of an insight, which was, I have to say that I was kind of surprised that they didn't close down the combined arm in that study when the Cairo-2 trial was reported. The PACE had been previously reported. And I really have a lot of respect for Alan Vanook and all the people involved with that. But I think I just realized why they didn't, because they want to look at the tissue and figure out what's going on.
See, I'm a supporter to keep the combination all open, because this is the last and really open chance to really understand what's going on.
Are they really going to look at the tissue, though? Or are they going to get
it? Oh, yeah. So they will, because we will not only retrospectively look at the combination arm, but now patients will be only involved with wild type, which I think will solve some of the problems, maybe not all. But in really to understand what's going on, I think it will be critical to keep this line open in order to really understand what happens by combining both antibodies in first line.
I got to tell you, Heinz, we have a medical oncologist who's still partially in practice and partially helping us. Her name is Karen Green, and she reviews all these programs, and she's like the voice of the doc. And she always is saying, you didn't explain this, you didn't say what that trial was, you're assuming everybody knows all this stuff, you got to explain it more. So all I got to say to Karen listening to this right now is I hope that you're following it. I think I sort of am. It's kind of going sort of fast. But let's go back to this lady when she had progression.
So she had a recurrence of a 2-centimeter lesion. So we started again FOLFIRI, cetuximab, bevacizumab. After 6 weeks, the tumor started to shrink. We sent her back to the hepatobiliary surgeons. I didn't want that they resected right away because I really wanted to see if chemotherapy is still effective. And I was worried that maybe other lesions would pop up.
So it's interesting. That also leads into another point that, of course, we're talking a lot about on this MetResect thing, which is the raging controversy. Now, in this situation, this is a recurrence, but that was the point which you considered pre-op versus post-op treatment, and the Europeans, and there was an editorial in Lancet, and you're pretty pro pre-op, and a lot of other people are concerned about the impact on the liver and hepatic toxicity and surgical morbidity. And I think there's actually been discussion about doing a randomized trial on that.
Yeah, I'm here with the Europeans. I think this is a window of opportunity to really understand the biology of the cancer. And I think when you do that within a 3 month interval, you really avoid major liver toxicities. I think you will be in much more difficult situation when you resect a tumor and then you choose chemotherapy, and you will only know when it didn't work with another recurrence.
Incidentally, one of the things that's, you know, like Steve Curley and Nick Petrelli, who are surgeons involved with this thing, talk about is the underappreciated problems with obesity and diabetes mm-hmm. and hepatic resection. What was this lady's sort of physical status in that regard?
Well, she was relatively young with 36, so she was not diabetic, but she was obese.
And how obese was she?
She had more than 20% BMI. So she really, I was worried a little bit about the choice of FOLFIRI. Even I'm convinced it was the right treatment, which we now know, because FOLFIRI has a higher risk of liver toxicity and a higher morbidity and mortality after liver resection. But I was convinced that FOLFOX is the wrong treatment. So I took the higher risk in a situation which I usually would not use FOLFIRI when I want to protect the liver. So it was a challenge for me, the physical condition of putting her probably at higher risk for liver fattening, even she was young. So I was concerned a little bit. So I was very carefully following her liver function, which, as you know, is not giving you the full story. But after we did the resection, after 8 months, there was no major problem. So I was very relieved.
But you know, also you mentioned that she was very fatigued. Who knows? Yeah. Maybe in some way she took a harder hit on her liver. I don't know.
You know, this was, I think, a 9-hour liver surgery.
Wow.
And the patients who go under long, they have a long time to recover. There is a direct correlation.
So you put her back on treatment. She had a response.
So after 6 weeks, the tumor started to shrink. So I sent her back to the hepatobiliary surgeon. They said we can resect any given time. I stopped the bevacizumab. I continued 2 more cycles with FOLFIRI. And she underwent resection now about 4 months ago.
And let me just think for a second. Any reason that you chose to use bevacizumab in that situation as opposed to cetuximab or even both?
I used both.
Oh, you did use both?
Yes, I used the same regimen which led to the significant response.
So this was not on, she was off the study by then?
Yes, she was.
But you decided to give her the same combination?
Yes, I did.
So what happened next?
So she underwent resection, which was relatively easy. It was a small lesion. By the time of surgery, it was only 1 centimeter. The tumor had actually 90% tumor necrosis again, and she recovered extremely quickly. She was home at the 4th day postoperative and recovered quickly, and we started again with adjuvant chemotherapy.
So just to go back to what the sort of translational parameters were that caused you to think that she would not respond that well to oxali and would respond to irinotecan. What fraction of tumors that you test are like hers? Is she like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10? I mean, I don't think so.
Yeah, so that's a very good question, because the classification of these two markers, because we are now at the moment in the process of doing prospective clinical trials using these markers within SWOG. So we had to go through all the separation and the frequency of high and low. So we know about 25 to 30% of patients are low in TS and low in ESCC1. Now, interestingly enough, when we did our analysis with these markers, they seem to travel along each other. So in other words, what we see in the clinic happens molecular-wise. When somebody is highly resistant to one drug, it's more likely to be resistant to the other. That seems to be the case for these two markers. So patients who have high levels of either one of the genes have a higher chance to have another elevation of the other gene. So about 25 to 30 have low, which are great candidates for FOLFOX. The others, either one or both genes are high.
And what fraction of tumors were similar to hers, I guess, in terms of the quantity? You talked about it being off the charts or whatever.
So her level of ESCC1 was very high. So when you would compare it to all levels we measured in the maybe 2,000 plus patients, she would be in the top 10% of increased levels.
Although the kind of response she seems to be having, you wouldn't say you see in 10% of people.
No. This only means they're very high. So, right. But the interesting thing is what we have seen in a smaller study. It seems like in a FOLFIRI study we did, only 40, 45 patients, that patients with high ESCC1 did significantly better with FOLFIRI than patients with low. Now, this is not a direct mechanism, but you can imagine a tumor cell in completely disarray and chaos with upregulation of DNA repair has usually also DNA replication going on and expression levels of TOPO1, which is very high. So I think there may be a reason they may be more sensitive to a TOPO1 inhibitor.
So you're going to tell me that she finished 6 cycles of treatment and she's still free of disease a year later. That's my guess.
Well, she's in the middle of the adjuvant treatment for the second round because okay. The surgery was about 4 or 5 months ago.
So hopefully you'll tell me that in 6 months or a year.
You know, I think the fact that it took about a year to come back with one lesion, I think signals that actually there was a resistant clone, which we couldn't get. We knew that in this, we could not resect all the areas with lesions known and seen. I think this patient also really gives us a good example that in some patients with liver limb disease, we may have to plan a 2-stage surgery. And I think this is just an example because with a liver resection, what happens in the liver regeneration, you create an incredible growing environment, not only for the normal liver, but also for any tumor cells behind. So you have increased nutrition, growth factors, hormones, and if there is a cell surviving, it starts growing and grows very fast. And you know and identify with a resection where your resistant clone may hide.
So, you know, people come in every 3 or 4 years for a little nip and tuck in their liver. Is that what we're going to be
hitting? I think most of these will probably come back within the first 2 years. That's the nice thing about colon cancer, which is completely different to lung or breast. We can cure the patients in a time frame of 5 years. You cannot do that for lung or breast.
Okay, so I got a real easy question for you, Heinz. Just give me your theory. Why is it that people get metastases only to their liver and you can cure them with surgery? It just seems so counterintuitive.
Yeah, so I think there are two, of course, it's not an easy question, you know that better than I. But, you know, it's very clearly that the mechanism of metastasis for colon cancer is certainly systemic with the portal vein system, which drains to the liver. They like the liver because the liver provides an incredible nutrients and has a perfect environment to grow. Now, that's not the only thing which reasons the liver, but there is a seed and soil hypothesis. We know that cancers actually prepare the site of metastases by secreting certain cytokines and growth factors, and the liver seems to be responding very well to these signals. So I think it's not an accident that this is happening. Now, one of the other reasons is, and the reason for tumor recurrence, is certainly not only the cancer cell, but potentially also a colon cancer stem cell, which escapes and is chemoresistant and able to come back in a time frame. I think because of the pattern of tumor recurrence in colon cancer, which allows us to go in and cut it out, that we actually capture and resect potential colon cancer stem cells before they can metastasize and hide in different organs not accessible for resection.
You know, at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, we did a case-based satellite meeting, and the first case we presented was a woman with breast cancer and a single liver met. Mm-hmm. And we got into a big storm of controversy about tumors other than colorectal cancer. A lot of the investigators are of the mind, well, you know, in breast cancer is different than colorectal cancer. Even if you see a patient who only has it, you know, in their liver or lung or whatever, then maybe it's going to be more aggressive biologically, not worth it. But yet, we actually found when we surveyed docs in practice that they were referring a lot of women with breast cancer in that situation for consideration of surgery. What do you think? Do you think that colorectal cancer is unique biologically in this regard? Or you think that these kinds of sort of, I don't know, patterns of metastases exist in other solid tumors?
I actually would answer both to yes. I think colon cancer is very special because the metastasis from the primary colon to the liver is very well defined by an anatomical relationship. That's for breast cancer not the case. If you have liver metastasis with breast cancer, you need to assume it has gone through the lung, to the brain, to the bones and other sites. Now, saying that and recognizing it, if there is really control of disease in one side of the body with one or two lesions, and we have no evidence of anything popping up on other sides, I think I would consider surgical resection of this site. I think there is a little bit of paradigm shift within GI oncology because we would never have thought about that for gastric cancer or for pancreas cancer. And I think I see more and more when there is one liver lesion for a gastric cancer patient, why don't we go after? Because following the same paradigm we have done for colon. And I think I would not exclude breast, just recognizing that the success of this metastatectomy really depends on the extent of metastasis not visible at the time, and that the time frame for metastasis, as we know, can go up to 20 years. However, with control of disease over really an extended period of time, I would have no objections for resection.
Any other issue in terms of trying to avoid putting a patient through hepatic resection and having them develop, you know, widespread disease right afterwards is the strategy that you talked about before of giving systemic therapy, seeing whether they respond, see if other mets pop up elsewhere. Is that kind of the way you would think that through?
Yes, I'm a big believer in it. Actually, astonishing to me that most surgeons buy into this concept very well and operate after 3 months, even if resectable disease. But I have more people in my own peers who are doubting, and when something is resectable, take it out. I think we are losing an opportunity. And one of the arguments is, what would happen if the tumor would progress and become unresectable? In my opinion, if a tumor progresses aggressively under aggressive chemotherapy, it was not resectable in the first place. These are bad tumors which we have very little control, whatever treatment we apply to.
Okay, so final question. I saw your paper on stem cells. I've been curious about it. You know, it seems a little bit challenging to understand. Keep in mind now, Karen Green's going to be listening to you, making sure that this is understandable. So just like 2 minutes, I mean, what are stem cells? What's the strategy research-wise? And how's this going to impact what happens in practice?
Right. So I think at the moment with colon cancer stem cell, it will not impact practice immediately. But I think it will look at us, how we design and develop new treatment strategies in the future. Chemotherapy or targeted treatment right now is almost like unleafing a tree, but not necessarily unrooting a tree. And I think one of the mechanism of chemo resistance and the mechanism of tumor recurrence are tumor cells which are able to survive. Most of these who survive can have features of colon cancer stem cells. These are cells which can renew themselves and initiate tumor growth. But in their resting situation, they are completely resistant to any chemotherapy we have. So we think that one of the major mechanisms of chemo resistance and tumor recurrence is the presence of colon cancer stem cells.
And these now, are in the tumor?
Yes, they are located in the tumor and they're also located in the metastatic site. These tumor or these cancer stem cells actually originate in the depth of the colon crypt. They have very specific markers. The marker CD133 is usually used to characterize them. So we can isolate. I think one of the major breakthroughs last year was by an Italian group and by Dick's group in Canada. They were able to identify and isolate colon cancer stem cell from patients with cancer and grow them in vitro and in vivo. The understanding of these colon cancer stem cells and the treatments of it will be critical to really increase treatment strategies for patients with metastatic disease.
It also gets into the issue of heterogeneity within tumors.
Yes.
What do we know about that?
Yeah, so that's a very good point because the stem cell is basically the mother of the tumors developing, but Beyond that, like a tree with the different branches, the tumor cells will lose or gain certain functions because they usually go along with growth benefits and survival benefits. So there is a significant heterogeneity in the tumor itself. The colon cancer stem cells are significantly less heterogeneous, in fact, very homogeneous. But again, that is actually a kind of an interesting issue when you think about colon cancer stem cells from a patient with a genetic predisposition versus sporadic cancer, where we know this patient has a DNA mismatch repair mutation and the otherwise don't. So the colon cancer stem cell is not always the same in every patient either. But the heterogeneity certainly doesn't apply in the same manner than in the colon cancer cells you find around the tumor or differences between the primary tumor and the metastatic site. I think the problem in colon cancer in particular is that with the introduction of a lot of new medications, with the oxaliplatins and the bevacizumab and cetuximab, there was never a time really to assign treatment and test that prospectively. At SWOG as well as EOTC, we actually, and the MRCC, all these three groups are now using molecular signature to assign treatment. Beyond KRAS, the ligands of EGF receptor, SWOG will use TSESCC1, MRCC will use TOPO1 expression. I think over the next couple of years, we will see these markers entering into the clinic.
So you think without new agents, we might be able to materially improve the outlook on the disease?
Yes, actually I do. I really appreciate that you're giving people like me a voice in that, you know, people also understand there is something on the move. And believe me, I'm the one who is the most frustrated with the progress because for some genes I have worked 10 years on and my colleagues in lung cancer tested and not I. How can this be? So it takes a lot of convincing. But I tell you, in SWOG, we have two concepts approved. One for gastric and one for colon, where we will use these markers to assign treatment. And if these trials are positive, I think it will change the way we use our chemotherapies. I also think that there is too much pragmatism out and people switch and do combinations like they think, and it's because of habits, and they not think too much about, you know, questioning it. You know, you question certain issues and what should we do and what do we have to do? I say, why would I use FOLFOX and not FOLFIRI? Why? It cannot be just because it's my favorite, and it cannot be only because it has neurotoxicity. That's not good enough in the future.